And welcome. Good morning. This is WNRN. I'm Rick Moore. This is Music Radio. A special thank you to those listening on Richmond's 103.1. We are going to be talking about the coal ash spill and solar power here this morning. Our guests today, Cale Jaffe, he's the director of the Virginia office at the Southern Environmental Law Center. Good morning, Cale.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I appreciate you coming. It's always nice when people donate a little of their time on an otherwise nice Sunday morning. We also have with us Steve Nelson. He's the lead engineer at Zinman Energy. Steve?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, again, always nice. And over there tucked in the corner to prevent any problems, Ben Myrtle. He's the president at Renewable Energy Construction Services. Just new in 2014, correct?
Yes, sir. Thanks for having us. Nice to be here.
And Steve and Ben, I'll wander around in a minute, but no producer today, so talk a little closer into that microphone for me till we get a chance to do that. So the coal ash spill, Cale, I want you to give people a little, you know, do your AP reporting on what happened back on February 2nd, I believe, of this year.
Right. Well, that big news, that tragic news, is back on February 2nd when we learned that Duke Energy, with one of its old coal plants and old coal ash ponds down on the Dan River, which right near Eden, North Carolina, and flowing east of Eden, heading into Virginia and towards Danville, there was a major catastrophic failure of a stormwater pipe. And essentially what happened was the coal ash ended up going straight into this coal ash pipe that's 4 feet in diameter and just funneling all of that waste, all of this toxic coal ash waste, directly into the Dan River. There were farmers down river of it who said the river looked like you'd imagine cement looks when you're mixing it up, just this clean, massive sheet of gray just running down the river. The river literally ran gray, and the coal ashes moved 70 miles downstream. The big problem that this highlighted for us, and of course there have been other big coal ash spills. There was a huge one at a TVA coal ash pond in Kingston, Tennessee, back in December 2008. And what is sort of shocking to realize is that these old coal plants built in the 40s and 50s and 60s, what happened was, is they were burning the coal and making all this ash. They said, okay, we got to put it somewhere. Well, let's just dig a hole out back and dump it there. And that is literally what they've done. This coal ash at a lot of sites throughout the Southeast have been stored in these unlined earthen pits, really no more sophisticated than what you might see in a simple farm pond, right on the banks of some of our most beautiful rivers in the Southeast. And so the spill at Dan River really woke everyone up to realize we've got a lot of these coal ash ponds, these earthen pits all over the Southeast. We need to clean them up.
I mean, you know, simple, basic question, but why? I mean, if we talk about the fact that coal ash is sort of the residue that we might otherwise flush down the toilet, but we can't and we shouldn't because it is, I mean, it's waste. Well, you know, we talk about how, oh, the piping broke and it got into the river. Well, we don't put, you know, you shouldn't throw out all your chimney ash mm-hmm. into the reservoir, and you're supposed to clean up, after your dog if they go, you know, out near the creek. But coal ash, why are we saving it in a pit?
That's a great question. We should not be storing it like that. It's full of, you know, arsenic and selenium and heavy metals and some toxic, nasty stuff that should not be seeping into our rivers throughout the Southeast. And so one of the things that we have been pushing in lawsuits that we've filed and beginning in South Carolina and also in North Carolina is to require these big power companies to dredge out these old coal ash ponds and move that ash to dry, lined storage facilities that are away from these reservoirs and these water bodies that we rely on for drinking water, for fishing, for recreation. I mean, it just, it's hard to believe that the situation evolved the way it has.
So do we, I mean, we're still talking about the fact that we are sort of forced to keep it, right? It's the leftover sludge from burning coal. But the difference, what I'm hearing is that instead of putting it in a below ground or ground level pit that's theoretically lined with something to prevent it from seeping and spilling into groundwater or waterways, the vision that I got from that last comment you made was to put it in a silo.
No, it's still essentially a landfill. The current system, the way the ash is currently being handled right now, and this is true not just in North Carolina but also some sites here in Virginia, is they are not lined. It is just a hole dug in the earth. And there are points along the river, you can see it along the Dan River, you can see it at a couple other sites, where you see these simple earthen berms that are holding back all of this coal ash. And if you go by in a boat along the river and look, you'll see these bright orange streaks in a couple of spots. Those are seeps where the material in the coal ash pond is leaking into the river. There was a lot of attention, as there should have been, when this huge stormwater pipe failed. But the piece that we were hammering on, that I was hammering on down at a public briefing that EPA held on this down in Danville and then another one downstream in South Boston, was, yes, the failed pipe is a problem, but how about for hundreds of feet on either side of that failed pipe, there's just a simple earthen berm holding back millions of tons of toxic coal ash. We can't let it sit there like that.
Again, we are talking about the coal ash spill and coal ash, a little more general, that took place in early February of this year, Duke Energy down on the Dan River. Cale Jaffe here talking. He's the director of the Virginia office of the Southern Environmental Law Center. In just a few minutes, we'll bring in our other guest, Steve Nelson from Zinman Energy and Ben Myrtle from Renewable Energy Construction Services. Cale, so back to what happened down in the Danville area. This spill took place on February 2nd of 2014. But my notes found that on the Southern Environmental Law Center website, again, SELC.com.org.
We're .org.
We'll get into that in a minute because all this work by Zinman for the solar power and by SELC are all nonprofits. And a lot of people would go, what, attorneys doing work as a nonprofit? Forget it. But that's true. SELC.org.
Actually, and I have not tried the initials, so it might work. But southernenvironment.org is the URL that I usually throw out. Southernenvironment.org.
Southern Environment. And it shows that you originally went to court in January of 2013, mm-hmm. so more than a year in advance, to protect North Carolina groundwater from the coal ash.
That's right. So we filed lawsuits in North Carolina at several sites. There's a site near Raleigh, North Carolina, another one near Charlotte, another one near Asheville, another one near Wilmington over on the coast. We filed lawsuits covering all of these sites. And what was amazing is what happened. We filed those cases. The state of North Carolina, led by Governor McCrory, who, as many of you know or might know, was a 28-year employee of Duke Energy, the power company that's responsible for all of this mess. The state of North Carolina went to court to try to block us in all of those lawsuits. And what they did was they went in, they tried to overfile on top of us and propose what was really just a sweetheart settlement. They said, you know, we were saying you've got to move this coal ash away from the rivers. The state of North Carolina said, no, you can leave the coal ash where it is. Just study it, and to settle the lawsuits, to settle all these Clean Water Act violations, we'll just hit Duke Power, this $50 billion company, with a $99,000 fine. That was the proposal from the state of North Carolina back in July of 2013 after the cases had been going for a little bit. We obviously fought that proposed settlement, And the great news is just Friday, just 2 days ago, the state of North Carolina finally conceded they can't go forward with that settlement. So they've withdrawn their support for that sweetheart deal, which is great news. Doesn't mean that we've got the commitment to actually clean up the coal ash yet, but it is an important step forward that finally, after several months of litigation, more than a year of litigation, the North Carolina regulators are starting. Their language is getting better, I'll put it that way.
That's Cale Jaffe from the Southern Environmental Law Center website, southernenvironment.org. Steve, let me bring you into the conversation. Steve Nelson, he's the lead engineer at Zenman Energy. Your website?
Zenmanenergy.org.
So Zenman, that's Z-E-N-M-A-N.
Energy.org.
On your website, I found an interesting quote. It says, Zenman Energy says we are, quote, addicted to coal.
Absolutely. Well,
what makes you say that? Because obviously, we're talking about the nasty residue that comes out and how some of the legalities in different states, specifically in North Carolina, but I'm sure it applies in other states as well, that don't require companies to do their best at storing this in other places and being as safe as possible. So, but we're addicted to coal?
Sure. I mean, here in America, we have enormous amounts of coal. I mean, West Virginia is kind of considered the Saudi Arabia of coal. So we have a lot of coal resources here in America, and because of that, we burn it. It turns out that coal is actually not the cheapest form of electricity. Right now, natural gas is the cheapest form of electricity, and you can see that we are starting to burn more natural gas, and in the end it comes down to the cost of electricity, but we're certainly addicted to coal because we have a lot of it, and it's a very dense energy source. There are other dense energy sources such as plutonium and uranium. And what that basically means is that you can get a lot of energy out of a small quantity, whereas renewable energies are generally considered not dense, meaning that it takes a lot of land to make the equivalent amount of energy for a chunk of uranium versus acres and acres and acres and acres and acres of solar power. So anyways, I think we are addicted to coal, but it's something that we can break. We can break that addiction.
Ben Myrtle from Renewable Energy Construction Services. Just real quick. So we can do different. We can break the habit, but we aren't breaking the habit. There seem to be a very small percentage of people that are doing their best to break the habit. But you have done so, at least you are trying to get others to do so. What is your first approach? You come to me and say, coal, not the best thing. Here, let me talk you into renewable energy. How do you start the conversation?
Well, generally, it's a conversation about economics. Oil and fossil fuels in general are finite resources that are going to continue to increase in cost as time passes, whereas solar in particular is decreasing in cost very rapidly as technological advances are made.
Well, that's one of my things, and I'm going to get into that in just a moment. 11:14 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about renewable energies and the coal ash spill that took place on February 2nd of this year, and why that led me to want to do this show. Our guests today, Cale Jaffe, Steve Nelson, Ben Myrtle.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
TNN Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, TNN specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. TNN offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. TNN Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com.
Blue Moon Diner, 512 West Main Street, in the heart of Midtown Charlottesville, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner weekdays with brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Blue Moon has live music with Jim Wave every Wednesday and more music Thursday and Friday nights. The full calendar is on Facebook. Blue Moon Diner, feeding the community since 1979.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to my multiple errors as we start the day here on a non-snowy Sunday. Here as spring has joined us, coal ash, renewable energy such as solar power, Steve Nelson, Ben Myrtle, Cale Jaffe here in the studio with us. Steve, Ben mentioned talking to people about that cost is one of the initial parts of the conversation when talking about solar and renewable energy. Isn't that sort of what holds us back from making this what should otherwise be a switch? Because to me, the image I always have in my head when for coal, for oil, is the earth is only so big, right? It's a nice round ball. Mathematicians and scientists have figured out how big it is. It takes thousands and thousands and millions of years to make coal and oil. So eventually we will use it all up. And if we suck too much space out of the Earth will collapse in upon itself. That's sort of the negative issue I have with wanting to not switch from coal and oil.
Sure, that I mean that's a pretty extreme view that it's going to collapse on itself.
I like to do the extreme thing.
Sure. Well, yeah, I always want to remind people that oil and coal and natural gas, I mean, and solar and wind, they're all renewable resources. You know, in the end, the world will make more coal. It will make more crude oil. It will make more natural gas. It'll happen. It's just a matter of the timeline that it happens. I've read conflicting numbers on how long it takes to reproduce oil, for the world to do it. And, it basically takes energy to create these fossil fuels. The world will do it. You basically have to take the elements together and you throw a bunch of either heat or pressure energy at it, and you end up making it. The world will produce it. And they're conflicting numbers of whether it'll take thousands of years or millions of years. And in the grand scheme of things, from the perspective of the world, those are small numbers. But from humans, those are huge numbers. And so, from our perspective, they're not renewable energies. Whereas, solar and wind, we get, if you look at the amount of energy that the world uses as a whole, there's something like 400 times as much energy from wind than the entire human species uses, which is a lot. But then you look at the solar, and there's something in the neighborhood of 10 to 15,000 times more energy hitting the earth in solar energy than the human species uses. So there's plenty of solar and wind.
But it's too expensive. That is the phrase that we hear regularly, not just from people who heavily wish to promote coal and oil, but when you go to the Zenman energy.org website, that is one of the key things. It doesn't say it's too expensive, but it says it's expensive. So how do we reduce the cost of solar and wind energy so that we don't have to pay for the cost of cleanup for a coal ash spill?
Absolutely. This has been a problem for a long time, and many of the solutions that leaders in Washington and leaders in political environment tried to do is they look at it from the perspective of, well, we should tax carbon. That was a big push a few years back, and personally, I think that's a wrong approach. I think the right approach is to just re-engineer it. Let's just think through how it works and think through the cost of producing the energy. If we can simply lower the cost of solar power below or wind and any renewable, if we can lower the cost of solar power below that of fossil fuel, the world will switch to solar power. You know, the reason Duke Energy, you know, burns coal is they make money on it. If they could make money on solar power, they would. At least that's my opinion. It, you know, whether that is true or not, I don't know. But people will make money when they can.
Kale Jaffe from the Southern Environmental Law Center, southernenvironment.org. I feel obligated
much.
Now that I've misgiven that information earlier. So Steve mentions the, what's the proper word, the carbon tax.
Yeah.
Reduce your footprint out of smokestacks, and then you can get tax credits, et cetera. But has that increased the groundwater tax? I made a note that reducing your coal air waste through smokestacks, does that increase the groundwater toxins?
Well, there are a couple different issues in there. And the first off is if you think of traditional pollutants, sort of the smog and soot pollutants, nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, things like that, mercury, fine particle pollution that we're capturing from our smokestacks. We say we don't want that in our air. We don't want that in our lungs. So we're going to require coal plants not to shoot that stuff up the smokestack. Well, of course, you can't just magically make it disappear. So if you capture that stuff out of the smokestack through air pollution controls, it ends up in that coal ash, which is then stored on the banks of the rivers and could very well pollute the rivers. I think when you're thinking about, and this is a bit of a transition point, but when you're thinking about the total costs, you really have to think of the costs cradle to grave, the whole piece. I mean, if you go buy a car, you don't just look at what's the price you pay the day you buy the car. You look at how much is it going to cost to operate? What's its resale value going to be? What's it really going to cost me to own this vehicle over the whole life of the car? We have
right,
to do
that's
this.
Why you look at consumer reports, right, to see what your gas mileage is, which is to see how often it has to go back to the repair guy and all the other parts of that.
Right. You're looking at the full cost of ownership. And we got to do the same with our sources of energy. You know, the big coal ash spill in Kingston, Tennessee, the TVA spill in December 2008, looking now 5 years later, more than 5 years later, TVA has spent $1 billion to clean up that one spill. And of course, there's still a lot of damage left. You look at a carbon tax, something like that, that's what you're really trying to do is get the power companies to take care of all of the costs associated with a given type of fuel. So a carbon tax, well, a coal plant is contributing greatly to global warming. One of the most significant threats, the most significant threat for the Southeast and, of course, for the planet as a whole, the carbon tax is saying, hey, that cost is real. You can't assign a value of zero to it. So we're going to try to figure out what it should, you know, what that cost is and put it in a tax. And then the companies will begin doing the rational economic thing and saying, okay, actually, as we look at it, we look at that cradle to grave cost of coal. And hey, from the coal ash pollution to the carbon pollution, it's actually not cheaper than some of our renewable options.
One of the phrases that I found online as doing my research for today's show, we're talking about coal ash, specifically the spill that took place February 2nd at Duke Energy down at the Virginia-Carolina border. Kale Jaffe's here, the director of the Virginia Office of Southern Environmental Law Center. We have Steve Nelson. He's the lead engineer at Zinman Energy. Ben Myrtle, president of Renewable Energy Construction Services, as he includes solar power into this conversation. Coal ash has less stringent disposal rules than household garbage.
That's right.
Explain that. I mean, I'm sure that everybody listening just went, what? No way. So explain that a little bit.
Right now, it is largely unregulated. Their EPA has been studying whether to treat coal ash as a toxic substance under federal law or not. They have not yet moved forward on that. Congress has not moved forward on that. The Kingston spill back in Tennessee really woke people up to the need of, hey, we've got to figure out how to regulate this stuff. But so far, there's just been a lot of, sort of shrugging of shoulders, really.
How, and this is where I start getting frustrated, because scientists say that global warming exists, and a noticeable portion of Congress says, no, it does not. Scientists say that lead and mercury and arsenic are toxins, and they are part of coal ash. Does Congress say that that's not true? And if they say that, oh, no, sorry, it is true, we do agree with science on the issue, then how has nothing been done?
Well, let me give you a story. It doesn't necessarily answer your question, but gives you an insight into the lunacy of what's going on right here. I was down for one of the EPA briefings in South Boston, farther downstream on the Dan River, talking about the coal ash spill. And all this waste is now in the river, and they're dredging it out. And we know that the coal ash pond where that waste is being kept is just a simple earthen pit. We know that the berm might be leaking. There's no liner to it. And yet the EPA officials are saying, well, we have to put that the ash that we're taking out of the river, they're putting it back in the same pit that was leaking in the first place. And when asked why they're doing that, they said, well, if we wanted to take it to a different place off-site, that place would have to be permitted and certified to be able to manage this waste. And since we don't have a place like that nearby, we're just going to put it back in this unlined hole in the ground that caused the problem to begin with, and that might still be leaking. That's the lunacy of what we're dealing with.
I would say lunacy, that's a great word as a descriptor for that. Cale Jaffe talking about, I don't know why, that's sort of laughing out of sadness on my part. Please don't take that for anything else. Steve Nelson from Zenman Energy. So as I hear stories like that, it becomes more apparent to myself, I don't know if others on air listening to us can agree, that renewable energy such as solar energy should be given more faith than they might have, or certainly more attention in bringing them forward. And we keep coming back to the fact that cost is one of the initial words that cause people to turn their back. But Zenman Energy is looking to reduce that cost. Again, a little quick description on how you do that at Zenman Energy.
Absolutely. So I'm working on what's known as solar thermal power, which if you look at, Cale was talking about the total kind of cradle to grave cost of various forms of energy, and you know, the Energy Information Administration publishes what's known as levelized costs of energy, and they as far as I know, they don't include things like, you know, spill cleanups. But in any case, they have different levelized costs, which, you know, there's upfront costs, there's fuel costs, there's maintenance costs, et cetera. Right now, natural gas is the cheapest, and solar thermal, which is what I'm working on, is the most expensive form of energy. Just to throw some numbers, natural gas is roughly $65 per megawatt hour. Wind is about 80 at the second place, and then which is cheaper than coal. And then solar thermal is dead last at $251 per megawatt hour.
Good Lord.
It's expensive. And, from my perspective as an engineer, I look at that and I say, whoa, that's got a lot of room for improvement. I've studied the systems that are currently in the field, and, they're precise machines. You know, there are these expensive mirrors that focus light onto expensive steam pipes, and you know, they run the steam through expensive turbines, and there are ways to make it cheaper. You know, the science doesn't need to change so much. It's not that they're doing it wrong. They're doing it absolutely right. But they're just, they're different ways to do the same thing, to achieve the same science. You can use different materials. You can use different construction designs. You can, change the engineering without affecting the science, if that makes any sense.
And your goal, or Zenman Energy's goal, if I understood this, you are on Facebook, by the way,
yes,
correct? Is to not just find a better way, but to find what I read to be as the least or certainly an incredibly less expensive way. And as that is found, is to give that information away freely.
Absolutely. Mind if I tell a little story as to how this started?
Do your thing, man.
Sure. I was intellectual engineering school 20 some odd years ago, and it was back when the .com were coming about, and I ended up switching out of electrical engineering into computers, and I did computers for about 15 years. Then I had my first first kid, a boy named Miles, and my wife is a pharmacist over at the Children's Hospital in Norfolk, and we had the discussion that all families have of, you know, what are we going to do with this new baby? And so I said, well, you know, I'm just doing some work for a corporation out in Detroit at the moment. And, you know, this is not very noble work, and you're a doctor. You know, you're literally saving kids' lives. So your job is more important than mine is. So I said, I'll be a full-time dad. So I become a full-time dad, you know, basically retire from computer programming, and I get bored. I'm bored out of my mind. And so what I do is...
I can envision all these mothers who are listening going, good Lord, you're obviously not doing that job very well.
So what I do is I take my son Miles and I strap him on my back, and we go for walks every day. We do this, and, you know, I got in pretty good shape. I'd walk 5 to 10 miles a day with a, you know, 10 to 20 pound kid on my back. And as we're walking, I'd tell him about things. I just talk to him. It was kind of a one-way conversation. He's getting a little older, you know, 7, 8 months old, and he starts pointing at things, just kind of grunting at things, you know. And he pointed a car, and I'd tell him, you know, that's a car. You know, that's how we drive around. You know, he pointed a house. I explained a house. One day, he starts pointing at some power lines. And so, you know, I'd tell him about power lines. You know, this is how we get electricity to our house. And, I'm kind of going into minor detail. And the next day, we go for a walk. Points at the power lines again. I'm like, that's really weird. So I tell him more about this. And so I start telling him about, you know, circuit panels and circuit breakers and, you know, voltages and transformers. The next day, he points at the power lines again. This is really odd. So I'm going into detail. And he's doing this for like 2 weeks. And I literally run out of things to tell him. And so I pull out my electrical engineering books and I start telling him about Ohm's law and, you know, we're getting into, you know, the stuff I didn't learn. I learned about, you know, some of the circuit stuff. So I'm telling him about diodes and transistors and such. And then I start studying about where the power comes from and telling him about that. He's doing this over and over every day. And, you know, I'm starting to really learn about, you know, coal power and natural gas power, and then learning about solar. And I'm thinking about it. I'm like, man, I can make these solar power plants cheaper than they're doing. So I start studying the solar and I'm telling him more about it. Finally, this goes on for like, you know, a month or 2 months, every day. He's pointing the power lines. Finally, he can talk. So he points up at the power lines. He goes, bird. So he could have cared less about the power lines. He was pointing at birds. So in that time, I became a, you know, amateur expert at solar power.
But obviously bad at answering kids' questions.
I know, right?
Oh, 11:33 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about coal ash accident at Duke Energy and solar power and how that might be able to answer and prevent some future coal ash spills. We'll be right back.
WNRN thanks the following for their support of independent music radio.
The Villa, Charlottesville's old school diner at Emmett and Ivy. The Villa serves a full American breakfast all day. You can find burgers and specialty sandwiches for lunch, plus weekday lunch specials and an Italian dinner menu every night. That's The Villa, 129 Emmett Street North, and villadiner.com.
Automated Office Systems, providing WNRN with personalized local copier and printer service and maintenance. Automated Office Systems is headquarters for all of your computer needs, including sales and service of desktops, laptops, and tablets. Automated Office Systems, 434-979-0790.
Hi, I'm Robert McKinnon, director at Hartmore Farm Education Center, the only Montessori adolescent program on a working farm in Central Virginia serving students ages 12 to 15. You're invited on April 12th to our school showing. Tours led by current students are at 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. with a presentation of our nature-centered curriculum at 10 a.m. At 444 feet above sea level, our students engage with not just the world beneath their feet, but the natural environment within reach of their hearts and hands. For registration and information, visit heartmorefarm.org. I'm Robert McKinnon, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks for being with us today as we talk about coal ash and solar power. Steve Nelson from Zinman Energy, Ben Myrtle, Renewable Energy Construction Services, Cale Jaffe from the Virginia office of the Southern Environmental Law Center. Steve, you were telling a story about sort of getting involved and how you learned a little bit more about energy by talking to your child who really only wanted to know about birds. But on your website, I found this phrase, as we talk about cost and profit, your effort to reduce the cost to do this so the profit, potential profit, becomes more interesting to businesses like Duke Energy. You wrote, 20 attempts over almost 2 years to make a distortion-free reflector under $10.
Right.
How is that interesting to to me and to what you do?
Certainly. Okay, so I want to pull back this levelized cost chart. You can look this up on the web. One of the things that's interesting about, you know, comparing renewable energy with other forms of energy is that there's no fuel cost. You know, you look at these charts, and the fuel cost today is pretty low. But Ben brought up a point earlier that, you know, as we run out of fossil fuel, we will, you know, those fuel costs will go up, and you know, fossil fuel energy power sources will go up in price, whereas renewable energy like solar has an expensive upfront cost, but it has no fuel cost. So that's a big benefit. So this distortion-free mirror, one of the things that I discovered from studying solar thermal plants is that the mirrors are one of the largest expenses. So just to kind of explain this, if you kind of remember parabolas from geometry class, all parallel lines that hit a parabola will go to a focal point. And so this is one form of solar thermal power plant. Basically, you point the parabola at the sun, the light rays hit the reflector, and
it's a magnifying glass.
That's exactly right. And the parabolic trough design is one of the most dense solar designs. There are other ones that they're working on. These power towers are kind of all the rage in the solar industry. When I studied the parabolic reflectors, I found that there's a part of the system called the substrate. Basically, you have a reflective mylar material that's attached to a metal surface, and it gives it that curve. It kind of maintains that curve, you know, and I'm starting to kind of price out the individual pieces, and that substrate, the backing that the mylar attaches to, is one of the most expensive parts. And so, you know, I looked at that and I was like, well, could you make it cheaper? Could you, you know, can you make that out of plastic? Can you make it out of, you know, do you need it at all? Actually, one of the first ones I made, there was no substrate at all. I just had mylar, and anybody that's ever played with this mylar stuff recognize that it wrinkles like crazy. And this is where all this distortion comes from. And so that post that you were talking about on Facebook, I had made a substrate out of all things fishing line. So basically the fishing line was what the mylar rests on. So if you can kind of picture the difference in cost between a big sheet of steel and fishing line, you'll say, well, the fishing line will be less, you know. So for, you know, $500, you can get a sheet of steel. For $1, you can get fishing line. So,
so there we go. We're off on trying to make it less expensive. You've already found, I don't know how key that is, but certainly a part of what it costs to make solar energy, and you've already reduced it by 80% from 5 to 1.
And if I just jump in on that, the Steve's research will, I'm sure, change the world on terms of the solar dynamics. which is exciting. We've also got the Department of Energy has got a sunshot initiative, excuse me, where they are challenging researchers to drive down the cost of solar. Right now, a lot of that energy in the Sunshot Initiative is focused on photovoltaic solar, different from solar thermal. And those costs, at least right now, are a lot cheaper than thermal, but also cost competitive with a lot of traditional fossil fuel resources. So the solar world is fast moving. And
so it's happening.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Sunshot program has solar thermal grants. They do both photovoltaics and solar thermal. I mean, it's a fantastic program.
And their goal, I think, is to get the cost of solar to be
less than fossil
by 2020, I think, is their target.
Well, solar has come down significantly in recent years. Just not that long ago, you know, price per kilowatt hour was in the double digits. And now, realistically, you can have a PV system installed for less than $4 a kilowatt hour.
But you're still not. And Ben, from Renewable Energy Construction Services, when I hear that phrase, what I'm hearing is somebody, you know, sending me a flyer in the mail saying, hey, we'll come, you know, turn your house into solar powered. But So question one is that true? Is that what your business does? And part two is, how realistic is that for the average family?
Well, it's really a question of ROI, return on investment, for a lot of folks. I formed Real Estate and Construction Services back in 2011, and that is the main company. Renewable Energy Construction Services is a division of that. We formed in 2014 based on the interest we had from current and potential clients. So I wanted something that I could offer them services, and not just necessarily solar, but all renewables. We'd like to really incorporate hybrid systems. I feel are the most effective systems to use.
But can you do that for the average family? I mean, it's one thing if you have a family of, you know, eight and you're going to stay in that house for another 30 years, I can see a return on investment. But can you go to the average Albemarle County suburb and go through that neighborhood area and say, you know, okay, you might not make enough money, or you may be selling your house in a couple years, but to find a couple houses in that suburban street who can say, yes, the cost is now low enough that I'm willing to do this?
Yes, I'd say absolutely. A lot of the PV systems are, you know, under warranty from the manufacturer.
Say that again. What systems?
PV photovoltaic systems.
Okay.
Like, you know, standard solar panels you see on most
roofs. So the mirror panels.
Sure.
That's what the photovoltaic ones are, right?
The photovoltaics are
the reflector mirror-ish panels.
No, the reflectors are what the solar thermal is doing. So the reflectors focuses it onto a water pipe, or, you know, a steam pipe, and photovoltaics directly creates electricity. That's the kind of the panels you see on a rooftop.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the costs have come down significantly, but there's so many variables that go into factoring the cost of a system. Is it going to be a rooftop installation? Will it be, you know, on a grid in a field? What is the roof material? Is it shingles? Is it slate? Is it metal? Also, the actual municipalities, is there any tax incentives in that area, and what is that percentage? So the ROI can be a little tricky to calculate, the return on investment over a period of years, but the prices keep continuing to fall, and it's just a better and better investment every day that passes.
And Cale, we were talking before the show about Dominion Power. Dominion Power has some of explain that to me again, how in some point Dominion Power can just say, sorry.
Right. Well, so Dominion Power and Appalachian Power, too, are the two big investor-owned utilities, and they both have guaranteed, protected by state law, monopolies. You're not allowed to compete with them. And so, in fact, there was a solar company that came to do a solar project at Washington Lee, which is in Dominion Power's territory, and Dominion sent them a cease and desist letter to the solar company and said, hey, you can't compete with us. You're trying to act like a competitive service provider, and we're not going to allow it. The end result of all that wrangling back and forth between that solar company and Washington Lee and Dominion was Dominion agreed, and the General Assembly enacted a pilot program for what are called third-party power purchase agreements. And that's just in Dominion territory right now. It does not apply in Appalachian Power territory. But the gist of those third-party power agreements, power purchase agreements, is to say, hey, the upfront cost of a PV system might be more than an average homeowner, an average business can afford. But if we spread that cost out, you know, think like the lease on your car or car payment, you spread that out over a number of years, all of a sudden, we can't afford to do that project now. And that's what these power purchase agreements are all about. We've got a program dipping our toe in the water here in Dominion territory on that.
So let's, you know, that brings in the state government into our conversation. Again, Ben Myrtle's here, Steve Nelson, Cale Jaffe. So back to the coal ash spill that sort of prompted our show today. My homework says that the state of North Carolina and their, looking through my notes, their Environmental Management Commission was told by the state that they needed to inform businesses when they were coming. You had to give a date that, hey, Duke Energy, we're going to show up 3 weeks from now to inspect you to make sure you're following the laws. And so Duke Energy apparently said, no problem. And any of the errors that they might have been making, it gave them 3 weeks to find them and correct them so that they couldn't be fined. And then if those errors mistakenly started up again 3 weeks and 2 days later, we're sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're pointing to, Rick, and this is a huge problem, has just been the cozy relationship in North Carolina between state regulators, environmental regulators, and Duke Energy. You know, as I mentioned earlier, the current governor of North Carolina, 28-year employee at Duke. So obviously he's got a lot of good relationships there. And in fact, you know, it's not just us sitting here in this studio that have been concerned about that. The federal government, federal officials, have launched a criminal investigation. And they are subpoenas out there looking into the relationship between Duke Energy and North Carolina officials. So that's still pending, and I think it's fair to say that pressure from that criminal investigation, that federal criminal investigation, is part of what inspired Duke, rather a little Freudian slip there, North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources officials to withdraw their support for that sweetheart deal.
I also found that we were talking about how the coal ash is stored. It's stored in an earthen berm to prevent it from going elsewhere on the property. But because it's not lined, I think you said that earlier,
That's right. Not
legally required to be lined, it is still leaching into the groundwater, but the North Carolina laws and regulations said that it wasn't contamination until it had actually leached into the neighbor's property. So if the contaminants were to go straight down into the groundwater, that was okay. It wasn't a problem until it had gone sideways and straight down and gotten into the groundwater, correct?
Well, there are a couple of different pieces there, but I think to get at what you're talking about, there's a question about it contaminating drinking water. And obviously, that's a major concern. It's been a driving concern in North Carolina. And for communities downriver and near Danville, they're upset about that as well. But there's also, even if your public water treatment facilities can filter out all those pollutants and make the drinking water okay, there's still the contamination and the environmental degradation in the river. You know, we heard anecdotal stories of folks who were talking about these turtles who were climbing out of the muck on the banks of the river and dying right there. There was one hearing I was at where the Fish and Wildlife Service person, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service representative said, you know, we're looking for evidence of species that have been harmed. And a woman in the audience held up this jar where she had a dead turtle. And she said, here's some evidence. I pulled this out of the river today, dead turtle. So, there's a lot of harms beyond just what ends up in our drinking water that we need to be paying attention to.
Steve, go back to Zenman Energy. One of the things that we talked about, or that I found that we haven't talked about yet, is that Zenman lists a phrase called reengineering old science as one of the goals and efforts to reduce the cost. I felt like we got just on the cusp of that and didn't jump into that when you were talking earlier.
Certainly. Let me tell you about another part of this system. I mean, we were talking about this distortion-free reflector. That's only one of, I don't know, 1,000 pieces of this whole system. The basic way this system works is sunlight hits a reflector. It concentrates onto a single point, onto a steam pipe, which is insulated with glass and a vacuum. The water inside that steam pipe gets blazing hot, and then it turns to steam, pressurizes the steam. Then that steam turns a turbine. I did quite a bit of research on different types of steam engines and steam turbines, and there's one that really caught my eye, made by famous guy Nikola Tesla 100 years ago or so. Everybody, he's become a household name these days. Anyways, he developed this this turbine called a boundary layer turbine, and there've been kind of back and forth studies on this over the last 100 years, and they've essentially gotten this this turbine to the point where they estimate it's between 70% and 90% efficient. And to just put that in perspective, a car engine is maybe 25% efficient. But you know, the important thing about this is that this boundary layer turbine is unbelievably cheap to make. I don't know if you can picture a turbine from a like a jet airplane where they've got a whole bunch of kind of fan blades. The turbine that are commonly used in coal plants and nuclear plants and gas-fired plants are very similar to the type of turbine that you have in a jet airplane. It's basically a whole bunch of fan blades. And to make those turbines is extremely complicated to make. You have to have these very sophisticated machines to basically make a bunch of wax and then you pour metal in there. When they break, they're very, very expensive to repair. Companies like GE make these types of engines for all the various power plants, and they make a lot of money on them. And so, you know, they like them because they can make a lot of money on them. This boundary layer turbine is made up of a series of discs that can be cut with a, you know, $5,000 CNC machine. You know, literally you can make one of the, I'm making one right now. I'm making a plasma cutting CNC machine to cut this boundary layer turbine. And they're just a series of discs. There aren't, you know, these funny blades that are on an angle. And, it's as efficient as the bladed turbine, but it, you know, is a fraction of the cost of making one of these. So this is, you know, this is a science that's been around for 100 years. It's in the public domain and, you know, we're not using it. And I'm going to try and bring it back.
So why don't we use it? I said several times that almost this entire conversation for the hour is driven by cost.
Sure. Yeah. Interestingly enough, it is in use. And so it's in use. So if you have steam turn this thing, it'll turn a motor. But if you turn the axle of one of these boundary layer turbines, it turns into a pump. And interestingly enough, it's very commonly used in the oil industry to pump oil out of the ground and out of in the ocean because it can pump solid material, which a bladed turbine cannot do. So it is in use. It just happens to be used as a pump. But it's why it's not in use today. I don't know the answer to that.
11:54 here on the Wake Up Call. Just a few minutes left for our guests today, Steve Nelson, Ben Myrtle, Cale Jaffe. I want to remind everybody that next Sunday is Fun Drive Sunday here on the Wake Up Call. WNRN is looking for volunteers to join us for the whole week period. During the next Fun Drive, you'll be answering the phone. You can enter some simple information into the computers and help WNRN listeners make the donation to the independent music radio station that we love being. Please volunteer your time to help us during this very important spring fun drive, which begins March 28th. We have openings for Friday evenings, weekday mornings, and daytimes all week. Please contact us at volunteer@wnrn.org. And thank you for all you do to keep independent music radio and the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on the air. And by the way, next week, my nephew will be back to help me. Wren will be here as we interview the Charlottesville Time Bank, bringing back the barter system for people who can still exchange skills and services rather than actual cash. I wish I had some service or skill to trade, but I don't. So back for a few minutes with our guests left. Kale, the SELC, Southern Environmental Law Center, or southernenvironment.org, I saw a solar initiative on the website.
Yeah, we've launched a solar initiative where we're trying to promote solar energy throughout the Southeast. Virginia, the PPA program. You know, what's exciting sitting here listening to, you know, the projects that Ben is installing and the research that Steve is doing. It reminds me of a report that the power companies put out, the Edison Electric Institute, research arm for the big power companies. And they put out a report a little over a year ago that identified solar as what they called a disruptive technology. And what the industry's report said was that they were concerned that solar energy will do to traditional power companies what smartphones have done to the traditional copper wire telephone industry. You know, back in 1982, when that first huge Motorola phone came out, the AT&T and Ma Bell, they weren't worried about what that new technology might do to them. But of course, it completely revolutionized communications. And the same, we are on the cusp of the same thing happening in terms of energy production. We have been relying on these coal-fired power plants, these huge utility-owned systems that we see what the problems are. And here, sitting in this room, this is, you know, the next Steve Jobs is coming out of the solar industry. And that's what's really exciting to see coming.
Yeah, to that point, right now, the there are two large power plants in Virginia. One's a private one that's at 504 kilowatts, I think, 503. And then the naval base has a 2-megawatt plant. But if you think about that to what Cale's saying is, you know, there are not very many 500 kilowatt systems. That's not that big. Just to put that in perspective, that would run 500 microwave ovens. So it's not enormous, but it's much bigger than you would have in a house. In any case, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, one 500 kilowatt system, but what if there were 10,000 500 kilowatt systems in the state of Virginia? We wouldn't need any coal plants. You know, it would satisfy all of our energy needs. You know, there are ways to store energy. So, you know, we can create the energy from the sun, and we can store it for overnight usage. There's a lot of, great potential with the sun.
I saw where Warren Buffett recently ordered $1 billion in wind turbines. So do we have any solar purchases like that, or is somebody out there, you know, trying to play the bracket and win their $1 billion from him so that they can, you know, make a solar purchase?
There are companies, I think, primarily in California because because of the way they set up their, they're basically trying to get solar. There are numerous companies in California that will basically fund the upfront cost of solar power and essentially install photovoltaics on the tops of your house or build, business for free. And then they cover the upfront cost. And then they also take the profit from when it produces more energy than, I don't think they're Warren Buffett level investors, but you know, they're smaller companies.
Well, let's hi ho for them, and let's wish them the best. All right, guys, it is that time, 11:59 in the wake-up call, time to finish up. Our guest today, Cale Jaffe, Director of Virginia Office of the Southern Environmental Law Center, southernenvironment.org. Steve Nelson, Lead Engineer at Zenman Energy, zenmanenergy.org. And Ben Myrtle, president of the Renewable Energy Construction Services, new of this year, so I don't have the web address.
It's actually recs-va.com.
All right. Best to everybody. I love the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
There's so much more we can talk about this still, so in the future we'll do a similar show. Everyone have a lovely Sunday. Next Sunday, back for the fun drive. Adios.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong
and Max Cecilia Struther.
Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.
...919 WNRN Charlottesville.
I'm telling you, your money.
1011 W266 BQ Crozet serving Stanton, Waynesboro.
You're a bad man. You're a bad man.
89.9 WNRS FM, Sweetbriar, Amherst, Lynchburg.
Keep a smiling at how money I want.
Les Temps-Purdue on WNRN.